From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, the case for why the state is stepping in to assist African-American-owned businesses.
I think the taxpayers' monies are invested very appropriately because it does encourage companies to grow and jobs to be created, which is encouraging other companies in the community through a ripple effect.
Later, are we on the verge of driverless cars in America? Famed Milwaukee chef Sandy D'Amato looks back at a delicious career, and the latest Milwaukee Rep production includes a unique set of props.
There are 7 doors.
Oh, no.
And they're constantly opening and closing. There are 7 doors, and there are 4 plates of sardines, and they are very, very important props in our show.
Lake Effect is next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's so good to have you listening today. For the first time, Wisconsin's state economic development arm is targeting business development specifically in the African-American community. The revolving loan fund just launched by the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation in partnership with Milwaukee's African-American Chamber of Commerce is the latest in a series of initiatives targeting specific communities facing specific challenges. Reed Hall is the secretary of WEDC. Dr. Eve Hall is no relation. She is the president of the African American Chamber of Commerce in Milwaukee. Secretary Hall joins us by phone from Madison. Eve Hall is with us in the studio now. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Great to be with you this morning. Thank you.
Why at this time has the WEDC decided to work specifically on behalf of African American owned businesses?
Well, this is a continuation of an effort that we have participated in for a couple years in the minority community. In months past, we've supported the Native American Chamber, the Hmong Chamber, and the Hispanic Chamber for these revolving loan funds. And it's just a natural progression that we wanted to support the African-American Chamber also. And with Dr. Eve Hall there and her administrative abilities, now we feel very comfortable with making this contribution to the Chamber.
And so is this an acknowledgement by the WEDC that would-be and current, not just African-American business owners, but business owners in these other communities that you're talking about face unique challenges?
Exactly. That's why we support the minority chambers. We're trying to advance the business development in the minority area. We're pleased to do that. We think it's something that fits very well into our mission, and hopefully we'll produce some great jobs out of these programs with new businesses or entrepreneurs that start up.
Eve Hall, how significant is this loan fund, both to the African-American business community at large and to the work of your organization?
Well, to the community at large, it signifies a very important partnership and relationship with the state. We know that for many of our businesses, especially businesses of color, and in our case, African Americans, that finances ends up being one of the major impediments to growth in a business and expansion. And so we're now in a situation as a result of our partnership to provide support to those individuals that qualify. We're now an addition to the landscape, which quite frankly is something new in the financial world. Typically, it's been the banks. Here locally, there's been an organization called WIBIC, which you may be familiar with. They've been in this business for 25 years. Wendy's done a phenomenal job. But what's really important is as our minority businesses grow, as our population browns, that it's also important that we have cultural type of opportunities when it comes to lending and having that type of interaction when they have options to go into their particular communities.
Can either of you explain the concept of a revolving loan fund and why that's the specific tool being put to work here?
We have been involved with revolving loan funds around the state for some time now, usually with communities or local or regional economic development corporations. And the revolving part of it is you fund after an analysis of the opportunity a startup business or maybe a business that needs nourishment during their lifetime. And then that is paid back, and we can entertain more proposals in the future. But it's a good way of getting money into the community when usually these companies do not qualify for the standard routine normal bank loans because they don't have the history. So that's the niche that we provide with these revolving loan funds.
Well, and you're starting with, I think it's $100,000 in seed money. How much can $100,000 accomplish?
Actually, it's a $200,000 fund. What our arrangement is that WEDC provided the $100,000. We had to raise the match, which we were able to do. So technically, Mitch, we are providing loans anywhere from $5,000 to $25,000. And actually, we can go kind of $1,000 to $5,000 as well, but basically $5,000. So if you're speaking on $200,000 as a beginning, up to four at $25,000, which I doubt if we'll have that many at $25,000. I would say that most would be smaller loans for gap, for bonding, for operations. So there are a number of areas that we're supporting.
And so you would say, not to put words in your mouth, but something even as small as $1,000 to $5,000 could mean the difference between getting a business off the ground or keeping it going and not?
It could be. I mean, you never know. It could be equipment, could be a gap where they just need that additional funding. There are many situations that our businesses confront. And so sometimes that $5,000 or $3,000 can make all the difference in the world.
Secretary Hall, as you say, there have been similar loan funds established to assist minority-owned businesses in a variety of other communities. Are there already stories of how these loan funds have been put to work successfully?
Absolutely. I think the minority chambers, when one looks at the success of the Hispanic chamber, the Hmong chamber, and the Native American chambers, I think they have many success stories that we have been able to rely on to encourage our future investments in these programs. It's a niche of the community that doesn't usually qualify for the standard bank loan. So that's why when these things are successful, we're so pleased.
Well, and let me ask a philosophical question. There might be some skeptics in the audience who might say, well, you know, people who don't necessarily qualify for a traditional bank loan aren't qualifying because they haven't met the criteria. Why doesn't the state say, well, you know, it's sink or swim. This is how the free market works.
We do have a review process, and I know the African American Chamber will have the same underwriting process. You look at these alternatives, the proposals that are given, and if it appears to have a success story in its future and it can create jobs, that's why we put funding into these programs. Overall, I think the taxpayers' monies are invested very appropriately, because it does encourage companies to grow and jobs to be created, which is encouraging other companies in the community through a ripple effect to expand and move Wisconsin forward.
Dr. Hall, can you talk about the criteria? I mean, even though these businesses wouldn't always qualify for a traditional bank loan, you're not just handing the money out.
No. In fact, we actually have a revolving loan fund committee. And this committee consists of bank representatives as well as some of our community organizations that are involved with business development. So technically, we look at some of the same things that a bank does. However, we would give more leeway. We know that banks are definitely anti-risk. You know, so there is as much as possible, they do not want to take a risk with individuals that they provide loans to. We're the opposite. I mean, we still have to be very careful about who we're lending to, but we may give that person that the bank still didn't feel comfortable enough with that chance, because we still see that maybe they don't have all the assets, but they seem to be someone of integrity who is going to be able to make the payments and has identified other ways to guarantee that they'll be on top of what they're to do. In addition, Mitch will be providing coaching and support on an ongoing basis. And oftentimes, once again, when we think about our banks, banks do not provide that. They're not in the business to do that, and that's fine. But we, as a chamber, will make sure that the additional supports that are needed will be provided. And what can quite frankly happen in the future for many of our clients is that they will be loan ready or prepared to take on a traditional loan in which they may need to go to a regular bank.
This is, you mentioned WBIC before. This is one of the things that they do as well.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I've met with Wendy. I don't believe in reinventing the wheel. There's a reason that they've been successful for as long as they have. And part of their success has been that constant support with the clients that they serve. And so taking that model is something that we will do.
The businesses and the individuals who are starting the businesses, I would imagine one of the issues they have is they're not going to turn an immediate profit. What are the terms of the loan? How long do they have to pay these loans back?
We're basically 1 to 3 years on a loan. And again, now not everyone's going to be a startup. I mean, we've already had calls from individuals who are well into business and they want to expand and they need some support. Those individuals who are just starting, again, we will be very careful and thoughtful in how we support them. But please know that there are many that are out here already doing fairly well or on the cusp that just need that extra lift.
The WEDC put in the initial $100,000. The African American Chamber of Commerce was able to come up with a match. Are there hopes? Is it possible that this loan fund grows down the road?
I would see it growing. I feel very confident that there are enough individuals in our community who need the support that would go beyond the $200,000. You know, one thing that the research shows, Mitch, is as minority businesses grow, they tend to hire other minorities. So this is another important element that as we support these businesses, the more we strengthen them, that means they'll be able to hire people. And so we have high hopes that that will happen.
We call that the ripple effect of the economy, and it truly is evident in many places.
So this is the notion that there's not going to be an immediate, enormous footprint in terms of the number of jobs created, but down the road, you look at this being able to spur other businesses and essentially a ripple effect.
Exactly.
Reed Hall, Dr. Eve Hall, thank you both so much. Appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure being with you today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Eve Hall is president of the African American Chamber of Commerce in Milwaukee. Reed Hall is the secretary of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. There's a link to more information about the revolving loan fund directed at African American-owned businesses at wuwm.com/lake effect. Google is in the testing phase for cars without drivers. Leaving aside the search engine puns, what are the implications for a driver-intensive culture? We'll explore those questions next on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The idea of a driverless car has always been the stuff of science fiction, or maybe not even science fiction. Even George Jetson sat in the driver's seat of his personal flying saucer. But driverless cars are a technology that may well be on our doorstep. The technical aspect aside, though, is society and is our psyche ready to relinquish control of the steering wheel? And where will the consumer fit in? The debate may be driven as much by insurance companies and lawyers as by the driving public. Lake Effect Automotive contributor Mark Savage tries to steer the conversation, so to speak, with our Dan Harmon. Savage looks at where things stand today.
Well, I think in practicality, it's not that far off that we could have that. It's when we can have that that meets all the right safety standards and that the automakers feel secure and that they're not going to get sued every time someone crashes, which liability is one of the big issues of this. But I didn't want to get into that right away. But the way I look at this is that there are a lot of sensors and software that go into the cars now. And I think this all started with cruise control of things to help us drive our cars either more easily or more safely. And cruise control also helps you with the fuel mileage it has over the years. So that's great. you know, then we get things like traction and stability control, so you're not going to spin the car as much or spin the tires as much, anti-lock brakes so you can stop more safely. And now we have all sorts of other things. There's electronic controlled transmissions, which I know we've mentioned in the past that they're so efficient that they're, you know, super fuel efficient. And I think what I've seen in the last couple of years is more parking sensors and backup cameras and so forth, so you don't back into cars when you're parking. I just did it over the weekend, had a car with a backup thing. It was perfect for getting and parking downtown, not far from here near the public market. And you could see exactly where that car is behind you. You can parallel park very easily. But having said that, now we have cars that will parallel park for you at the press of a button, basically. And I believe it's BMW is coming out with one that will also perpendicular park so you can go into a parking lot and press the button, which, I mean, to me, these are very easy things, fairly easy things to do. Parallel parking may be a little more complex. But it's possible to be doing all this because we have all these sensors on the cars. Some are already there and some are now being added so they can look at the lanes and they can see the lines and they can measure what's next to you. So it's not that far off. I mean, I have an example. I know I'm rambling on here, but I just had this Lincoln MKZ has the lane departure system. Many of the luxury cars have that now, but most of the time it just beeps at you incessantly when you get close to a line on the side of the road, either side of the road. That to me is annoying, and actually I think it can startle the driver enough that maybe it doesn't help you drive more safely. But this one slightly corrects your driving. So you're driving, you wander towards that center line, and it just slightly tugs the wheel, you know, in your hands just slightly back, you know, over to the right so you're back in the center of the lane, and always does it on the other side too. I tried it. I only had it not see the line one time in my week's worth of driving. So if it can center you in the lane, in theory, you can keep driving even when you get to a turn in the road and it's going to sense where that line is and keep you going around the corner. Now, it would probably have to read things a lot quicker than this does even. And I'm sure you're going to want some backups on that. And maybe we need to have sensors in the roads too, which would take a lot of infrastructure. And that would take forever for us, I think, to get that into this country as bad as our roads are. But it is possible, and more cars are getting all these electronic sensors in there that will help at least keep you in your lanes.
I wonder how well that will work on our, you know, in the snow belt, you know, these lines that get washed out. I mean, they're not even there anymore.
Well, and that will be an issue probably here more than it would be, let's say, in Florida or California, where you're less likely to have your lines eroding from the side of the road or covered by ice, snow, slush, whatever. But I'm guessing that over time here, I don't know, you know, maybe it's going to take another 10 years to get all this figured out, but it won't be long before you can just sit in your back seat and relax and let the car drive itself.
I have to ask though, who is the driving force, excuse the pun, behind driverless cars? I mean, every driver I talk to or ask them, they don't want this. So what is the real force behind it?
Well, I do sometimes think it's if they build it, they will come. It's technology, and it was, as we've said in many other times, is sometimes the technology is for technology's sake. And I guess there's nothing wrong with proving you can do this. And there have been several contests where people are given, you know, $1 million if you can come up with a car that drives itself and so forth. That's great. I don't know that there is a big driving force, as you say, to get people to not drive their cars. But I guess in the long view of looking towards how to make cars safer and safer, this is another option that's out there. And, you know, is this a great option? I don't know. My concern is always that it keeps adding more and more cost to the car. And, well, I enjoy driving, so I like being behind the wheel and being in charge of the car. So,
I mean, there's some really great safety features like the backup that mm-hmm. you were just saying, and then accident avoidance things, which will hit the brakes for you. And they, whatever, and I will not ask if this is an insurance driven thing, because the collision avoidance technology will almost eliminate a lot of rear-end collisions
right.
for
and
you. So is that another reason for this, is insurance?
Well, insurance, I'm sure, will like a lot of these features, like you say, that avoid dents and dings and in more serious accidents too. I don't know if insurance will like the liability issues that this will raise. Let's say I have a so-called self-driving autonomous car, and I'm sitting there reading my book as we're zooming down the highway at 80 mile an hour, 70 mile an hour, whatever the rules are at the time. And, you know, someone does pull on from an entry ramp and they're going much slower, and while it's beeping and buzzing and putting on the brakes, it can't avoid the accident and hits it. Let's just say it's a property damage accident. Well, whose insurance company's paying for it? Am I suing, you know, the automaker, the programmer, the company that did the programming, the hardware people, like the sensor? Was the sensor faulty? I mean, it's going to raise a whole different level of who can be sued and who's really responsible for the accident. Or is the driver ultimately responsible for all accidents? Well, you know, some cases have been made prior to this where something failed on a car and the automaker was sued. So
that was Toyota, wasn't it?
Yeah, Toyota and Audi also. So,
well, just a question that leaked to my mind that I'm not trying to be glib here was just the amount of drunk driving that goes on. Is this something that would really help, aside from people just not drinking and driving?
It's possible that this is a potential drunk driver's dream car, assuming you don't have to use a breathalyzer to actually open the door to get in and say, you know, take me home. And the car programs itself and keeps you between the lines and drives the speed limit on the way home. I mean, this could be a win-win for everybody in that regard. You know, I hate to say it, but Wisconsin has a lot of folks drinking and driving, and this may be maybe it'll be known as the Wisconsin feature on certain cars.
Well, all right. In all of these proposals and ideas, is there any discussion amongst the powers that be that, you know, how much is too much? When do you cross that line from driver-assisted technology to driverless cars, or however you put it?
Well, yeah, autonomous driverless cars. You know, I think some of us are asking those questions, and I'm sure that there's somebody in all of the car companies saying, is there a market for this? But you keep moving towards it. And maybe by the time that it happens, maybe it is 5, 7, 8, 10 years, I don't know. But it's I think, certainly foreseeable in our future. Maybe by then the market's there. I think those of us who think still spending $20,000 for a car is a substantial amount will not be able to have it on their car. So there's still going to be other people driving while there's this autonomous car is aiming itself down the road and doing what it does. I would think that maybe some wealthier buyers would be willing to take the chance on this and think, oh, this is kind of cool. I want to have the latest gimmicky, you know, interesting high-tech thing out there. I mean, somebody wants the iPhone 75 or whatever it is, right? So they may want this. I don't think it would be a big seller for the broad market because I think it's going to add a lot of cost to the car.
Right.
But it may be a market for somebody.
How much of this is GPS driven? Again, no pun intended. I mean, it exists. I mean, there's a car that Google has been working with to actually guide the car with GPS. So are these tied together necessarily?
Yes, I think they are. And I think GPS has become so much more prevalent and people accepting it and people buying it and people having it on their cell phones. So when they, you know, enter downtown area of a new city there and they can program where they're going to walk. It is definitely driven by that technology and I think people's comfort level with it. So again, you know, 5 years from now, maybe we'll all have a GPS thing in our glasses and we'll never have to look up anything ever again. And maybe this will just be accepted that my car knows where it's going. I don't have to. I just think that that's a little bit of a stretch for those of us who maybe won't be able to afford this right off the bat, and I think we'll be a little leery of that.
All right. Well, I guess we should enjoy driving our cars by ourselves for a while.
Drive your car while you still can, and be sure that there'll be some laws coming down the road to eventually limit this or put some brakes on it, as the case may be.
No pun intended.
No pun intended.
All right. Well, thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
Mark Savage writes about cars for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and is associate publisher for four magazines at Waukesha's Kalmbach. They are American Snowmobiler, Classic Toy Trains, Fine Scale Modeler, and Scale Auto Magazine. He's also our regular automotive contributor, and he talked with Dan Harmon. Milwaukee's fine dining scene has come a long way in three decades. One key reason has been award-winning chef Sanford D'Amato. We'll meet him and talk with him about his new memoir, When Lake Effect Returns, on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. One of the key people responsible for the rise of Milwaukee's fine dining scene over the past three decades is chef and Milwaukee native Sanford D'Amato. The James Beard Award-winning chef founded and owned Sanford Restaurant for 23 years, was the first American chef to break into the French-controlled kitchens of New York in the 1970s, and he just released his memoir with recipes called Good Stock, Life on a Low Simmer. Ahead of his appearances this week at Coquette Cafe, Chef D'Amato stopped by to chat with Bonnie North, and he said that food has always been part of his life.
My mother was an amazing cook, and then my grandfather was too. It was kind of funny with my grandfather because he was not the nicest guy in the world.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book,
right? But when he was working with food, there was this like dreamy smile that you just never saw that would come over his face. That was the only time. It seemed like it was the only time he was really, really happy. And he had said he really wanted to be a chef. And he had never, he had just never had that chance to do that. He became, became a grocer. And it was funny because he died before I got out of cooking school. I was cooking at the time, which he was really happy about. And,
but he never got to see what you achieved, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, well, it is. But The good part of it, I think, that he would really enjoy is the dishes that he did over the years that I incorporated into our food, both just making it at home but at Sanford too.
So how did growing up in Milwaukee at the time that you did, in this family that you did, affect the chef that you are now? I mean, what is it about this Milwaukee experience?
Well, I mean, everything that I've done over my life has been done here. I mean, from first time I cooked to my first kiss, my first, everything was in this city. And at the time that I was getting into cooking, my father, he talked to the PAP salesman. He had the grocery store, and that's actually where Sanford Restaurant came from. It was my grandfather's and father's grocery store over on Jackson and Pleasant. He told me about a place called Cults, which was an older German restaurant over on Oakland and Locust. And that's kind of where I started. They're doing Friday night fish fries, which every good Milwaukee cook or chef should know how to do, breading onion rings. And after I was working at Cults for a while, I wanted to get into some kind of a program. And back in the late 60s, there really weren't a lot of programs to get into. And I found out about one from the Jewish Vocational Services. The best part of it was that it was free. And so it was at a downtown building in Milwaukee, right on Wisconsin Avenue. So I went down there about 6 o'clock, and of course all the buildings at that time were pretty much deserted at 6 o'clock, and it was a kind of a creepy feeling going up the elevator and getting in. But there was this class, and just in one of the offices up there, it was run by a chef from Strucel's at that time, which was like a prime rib place over on the west side. It was Tom Radcliffe. And he had a group there, and I was the youngest by probably 15 to 20 years.
How old were you at this point?
I was 19.
Okay.
18, 19, right around that. Anyway, he was teaching, and he was a great teacher. But during the class, it seemed like none of the students were really that interested in the class. And I was expecting this kind of camaraderie of talking to all the students, and afterwards we'd talk cooking or go get some coffee somewhere, or I couldn't drink at that time, but this never happened. So after about 3 months, Chef Radcliffe called me into his office after class. He asked me if I could stay, and I did, and I didn't know if that was like a good or bad thing. But he's talking to me afterwards. He says, "You're really interested in cooking, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, yeah, isn't everyone here? I mean, that's why we're here, to learn to be chefs." And he said, "Oh," he says, "you don't know, do you?" And I said, "No, what?" And he said, "You're the only one here that doesn't have to be here. Everyone else is on work release from prison." So that was my first cooking school experience. So he's the one who told me about different options and told me about the Culinary Institute. And that's how I ended up going out there when they first moved from Yale's, they were on Yale's campus in New Haven to Hyde Park.
And then, of course, you're in New York and you're the first American to kind of break into that very French world at the time of fine dining cuisine. I imagine that, the techniques that you learned and the way to run a kitchen were things that you still use today. How much of that is incorporated into the cuisine that eventually became your signature?
Oh, it's all part of it. You know, every chef has a cooking signature of what they do. And it comes from their technique that they learn. And that's what I learned from, you know, working for the French chefs in New York, and what I learned for working for my other mentor, Peter Van Erp, who was a Dutch chef who I worked with at the Culinary Institute. And then they have their palate, which can range from any part of the palate. It can be some chefs go to the acid side, some chefs go to the sweet side, some are bitter. But it's all that incorporation that if you give one dish to five different chefs, you're going to get five different dishes. And if you know those chefs, if you know their food, you're going to know whose dish is whose just by the taste of that dish, because every dish becomes kind of a template of their journey, of where they've been and sometimes where they're going. And then the other part of your signature is your taste memories. And that's, I think, is the most important part. And it's really what makes distinctive food, because my taste memories are completely different from yours. So when you're looking at a dish, if people would incorporate that into their food, everybody would have really, really distinctive, delicious food. Everybody doesn't do that. I mean, now it's become almost kind of chic to go on and find what the new hot dish is and just take a recipe off the internet and make it. But what that becomes a recipe, and I tell everybody that works for me over the years, I mean, recipes are, they're really soulless frames without knowing where the food came from. And that's really what the book is about, is the stories, because without the stories, there is no food. There are no recipes.
And you incorporate all of these wonderful recipes. And I think about you say, of course, my taste memories are different from yours. But it seems that what you're offering here is a way for me to kind of get close to your taste memories.
Yes. Well, because, I mean, having said that that recipes are soulless frames, I mean, I better figure out a way in the book to put some soul into them so that people buying the book and making the recipes have an idea of what I'm thinking of when I'm making it and the technique that I put into it. So that's what I feel the story does. But it gives every reader the freedom to take that recipe and put themselves into it, which is going to probably make it different from what I would do, but possibly better.
And one of the things that really struck me that you said in one of the first little stories in the book of never forgetting that part of your job is to make the people eating your food as happy mm-hmm. as you are when you are making the food. And do you think that's something that we're missing a lot of times, that chefs forget that part of the job is to make people eating their food happy?
Well, it's very easy to get isolated in a kitchen and to not realize that there's someone eating your food. This isn't an ego trip. I mean, this is about comfort, and this is about making people happy. And as a chef, it's really important to understand that. And what I try to do at the restaurant, what we tried to do over the years at the restaurant, was to have everyone that worked in the kitchen and everyone that worked in the dining room too come in for dinner and to sit down and to actually be a customer and to see the food from a different perspective, that you realize that after a night of doing 100 people, when you're putting out that last dish, that person doesn't care that you've just put out 55 dishes. It's that person being there for the first time. It's kind of like to use a baseball analogy of, I mean, a great hitter. I mean, Ted Williams, one of the great hitters of all time, batted 405. I mean, if I batted 405 cooking, I'd be out of a job. I mean, you got to, and 9 for 10 doesn't, 900 doesn't make it. You've got to, every dish has to be perfect when it goes out for a customer, because a customer doesn't care that 9 other people got a great dish and they got a lousy one.
As you were choosing the recipes here, how did you pick them? How did you go through? Because I imagine there are many favorites that you have and things that bring back stories and memories for you that you would have liked to have included but didn't have room for.
Well, it was because of the stories. The stories brought about the recipes that are in the book. The last 10 recipes, because people always say, what are your favorite recipes? And so I compiled those in the last 10 recipes in the book. Those are my desert island recipes that I would have to eat for the rest of my life. You know, my the spadini you know, Sicilian spadini, the cookies, you know, having the pecan and brown sugar cookies, and those are all my favorite. Those are my favorite things. But all the other recipes have, you know, from the chicken pastina soup in the beginning to my variation on my mother's cinnamon ribs. It runs the gamut of simple to the ginger snap cannoli that did for Julia Child's 80th birthday. And that was really the transition dish when we opened Sanford between the grocery store and the restaurant.
Well, now that Sanford has a new owner and you are moving on to other things, you've got the book, you're still cooking, of course. As you look back at sort of the trajectory of Milwaukee's fine dining, we're getting recognition, but I'm curious where you think we're going.
Well, what's happening, and it isn't unique to Milwaukee. It's unique to the whole country right now, is when I moved back to Milwaukee in 1980 and I left New York, it was a big decision because I was leaving the epicenter of food in the world. And I was a pretty competitive guy, but I was looking for balance in my life. And I wanted to come back here for two reasons. One of them was for that balance, for relationships and to have a normal life. And the other one was I wanted to open up a restaurant. And I knew in New York I could open a restaurant, but I'd never own the restaurant because I'd never have that kind of money. What has happened since that time is that the rest of the country, the coasts, the media coasts, discovered that there was something in between and that there was great food all around the country. And it made it possible for chefs to move back to wherever they were from and to be able to do that and to be able to do the food that they want to do and to be able to survive. And that's what's happening in the city right now. There's not only chefs that are from here that have gone away and then come back, but there's other chefs that are just moving here that realize that this is a great, you know, it's a great way to live. It's a great lifestyle, but they can do the kind of food that they want to do and that they can survive and that people are going to support them.
So is there a signature Milwaukee style for somebody who's looking from the outside in?
I think people incorporating parts of the Midwest into their food, but it depends on their background too. You know, like Justin, who took over Sanford. I mean, he's bringing his Armenian background into the food, but he's also using all the products of the state. You know, it's really kind of funny talking about farm to table now that it is, you know, like, I mean, it is a signature byword of restaurants. I mean, that's the way food always was. It was always farm to table when it started out, because the only place that you could get product before it was shipped was you had to go to the farmer's market. And that's what restaurants ran on. I mean, and it was only in the 70s when flying fish started that they actually started flying food around the country, where you could get things from outside of the country even brought in. And that's not, I mean, it's, you know, 40, 50 years ago, but it's still very recent. I mean, in the 70s, cooking in New York, we had asparagus in spring. We only had salmon, fresh salmon in spring. There was no other time of the year where there was fresh salmon around. And a lot of chefs are doing this now, but they're cooking that way. Even though you can get strawberries all year round, you want to get strawberries in that, you know, that end of May, beginning June when they're the best and when they're local, when they're so fragile that they can't be shipped. People are starting to get it.
So what's next for you?
Well, for us, we have a place out in Hatfield, Massachusetts. It's right in between Northampton and Amherst, right on the Connecticut River. We're going to have a small cooking school, like, you know, hands-on 10 to 12 people at a time in our home. So we're building that right now. And then we've already planted, starting 4 years ago, planting the whole that area of the little under the 2 acres. And so we'll be able to go out and get asparagus or rhubarb, or we have 16 fruit trees that we planted. So it's all starting to come around right now. So the classes will be run around what is fresh at that time.
So training the next generation.
Exactly. And that's what you should do. One other baseball analogy, you know, you peak, you know, sometimes when you're, you know, in your 30s and then you become the wily veteran. You know, if you're still pitching when you're 40s, you're usually a freak of nature. But after that, you get into coaching and you get into managing and you get into teaching. I'm not going to stop cooking. That's my life. But I'll just be able to pass it on.
Well, Sandy D'Amato, it has been such a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Bonnie. Thanks for having me here.
Award-winning chef and restaurateur Sanford D'Amato was born and brought up in Milwaukee. He calls his new book a memoir with recipes. The full title is Good Stock, Life on a Low Simmer, and it's published by Agate Midway Publishing in Chicago. D'Amato will talk about his book and sign copies tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday at Coquette Cafe in the Third Ward. He spoke with Bonnie North. A last break, and then we'll preview the Milwaukee Reps production of the classic farce Noises Off when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Christmas season seems to start earlier and earlier each year. Witness the lights that went up along Wisconsin Avenue more than a week ago now. For those who might not quite be ready for mistletoe and all Christmas radio, the Milwaukee Repertory offers one possibility for a distraction. Noises Off has been called, quote, the funniest farce ever written. Written by English playwright Michael Frayn, the play within a play is the farthest thing from Christmas fare. It's directed by K.J. Sanchez, who directed last year's production of The Diary of Anne Frank at the Rep. The play has been around for three decades, but for those who might need a refresher or who just don't know the story, Sanchez talked with Lake Effect's Bonnie North and sets up the plot for us.
The comedy is about a British theater company that's putting on a production of a farce called Nothing On. Act one, we see them in rehearsal the night before opening. It's 1 a.m. They haven't gotten through act one of this play. There are these trysts that are developing between cast members. There are cast members that are lost. There are cast members that don't know where they're supposed to be standing on stage. The director's at the end of his rope. Act two, we see them a month later. They're in full performance. We're watching a performance, but we're backstage, and we watch all of the machinations that happen backstage as they're performing this play. And then act three is 2 months later. We see another performance, and we see what a state this theater company has gotten into. It's delightful. It's funny. It's such a great break. I am just finding, rehearsing it, getting ready to open, that it's just such a great break from all of the difficulties of our lives to just go in and just laugh your socks off.
And that's one of the things that in the productions I've seen is you are crying. You're laughing so hard because there's so much going on and just the absurdity of everything.
That's right. I didn't think it could actually be this funny. When Mark Clements asked me to direct this, I was very excited because I knew of the play. I hadn't seen a performance of it. I had read it and thought it was very, very funny. But I really honestly did not believe it could be this funny. I am weeping in rehearsal.
So what are some of the challenges to you as the actual director, not the director of the play within the play? Farce, I've always thought of as being one of those things that there's a fine line. You know, you cross too far in one direction and it becomes sort of thuddy rather than funny.
That's right. And the way that you keep from going too far is with precision and skill. There's an old saying in comedy that the fluffier it is, the harder you have to whip. We have to be so on point in rehearsal and we have to be so specific about timing and about delivery of lines because you're right, it can't get broad because then we all just get tired of it. But that's the beauty of this play. And I have to say, I am glad I'm doing it here at this theater at Milwaukee Rep rather than any other theater because I'm working with a lot of veterans of Milwaukee Rep, Deb Staples, Laura Gordon, John Daly, Jerry Nugent. And these folks have serious acting chops. They have skill. And so every day rehearsal is about being on point and just being really, really specific and very, very clear. And it's a great play because these actors who are performing these characters, nothing on the play they're performing is a farce. But the play that we follow and follow the lives of these characters actually does have some meaning. And these people are very likable and you really get invested in their lives. And so these actors can play very real characters who are the actors. And then they perform these farcical characters that the actors are playing.
Farce is comedy with more than three doors or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
And so are there many doors?
There are seven doors.
Oh, no.
And they're constantly opening and closing. There are seven doors and there are four plates of sardines. And they are very, very important props in our show. There are sardines that fall on people's heads. There are sardines that get carried around and balanced. There are sardines that get glued to somebody's body. It's pretty remarkable. And, of course, we have Jim Guy here, one of the finest props masters in the country, who is just doing an amazing job. He is making every single one of the sardines.
Wow.
He's making them by hand, and they look like real sardines, and they're wobbly and floppy, and they go everywhere.
Oh, my gosh. That is going to be fun. Yeah. That is going to be fun to see. And the other thing I love about when comedy like this is done well, you're talking about the precision. I've often thought that comedy was really, really hard to do well.
It's very hard to do well. It is very, very hard. And I guess, you know, if I had an autobiography, it would probably be called Too Dumb to Know Better. because I keep thinking every day, I keep thinking, like, should I be afraid? Should I be afraid of this play? Because comedy is really, really hard. And then at the end of a day of rehearsal, I watch a run through and I say to myself, no, these people, these actors are really good at it. So it's not as hard for them as it might be for others.
What about working with your design team to make this whole thing work?
Yeah. Dan Conway, the scenic designer I've worked with quite a bit. And early on, we decided to create alter egos for ourselves, that we each have an alter ego that is working on this play. My alter ego, her name is Chili Lopez. And she is a master at farce. And Dan Conway has developed his own alter ego. And what he's done with the set is he has created a set that looks like a designer, first of all, who didn't know a lot about Tudor architecture, but he looked at a couple of pictures in a book. There are pieces to this set that are sort of hodgepodge. It all looks amazing, but it doesn't quite go together. He's so good, and it's a really sophisticated set. It has to be able to spin around so we see the front and the back. All of these doors have very, very particular uses. We have a staircase, and one of the actors has to fall down it several times through the night. So just the conversations about what's the staircase, what's underneath the carpet of the staircase, how does he go down, and then can the women in the show be in high heels running up and down that staircase?
Thinking of all of those technical things to try to make it work so you don't actually have to replace cast members every night.
Yeah, that's right. The cast members not being replaced would be a really good idea.
That's probably smart.
That's probably a good thing to do.
Yeah, Chili Lopez would probably not get hired again.
Yeah, but Chili Lopez is known for her integrity and her work ethic.
Okay. So we think that it's going to be okay.
It's going to be okay.
Yeah.
We haven't had knock on – I don't have any wood in the studio, so I'm knocking on my head. Knock on wood. We haven't had any injuries. And these guys are so good. And Jerry Nugent does most of the pratfalls, and he is really amazing.
I think one of the things that would be so tough as an actor in a play like this is to keep a straight face, keeping character.
Oh, that's right. Watching them, I grew up in love with the Carol Burnett Show. Every Saturday, my ritual on Saturdays was take a bath, get in front of the television with snacks, and watch the Carol Burnett Show. And it is like a dream come true to be able to work on this play, because when I see the cast members working with each other, they're very fond of each other. Most of them have worked together quite a lot. And it's so terrific because you can see them doing what Tim Conway and Carol Burnett did, which is try to crack each other up and try to keep a straight face. And it makes the whole thing ever so delightful.
And then, of course, you're sitting there and watching to see if they actually achieve
That's
it,
right.
You know.
And I have to be – Chili Lopez has to crack the whip a couple of times. And she has to get at them for trying to crack each other up. And I have to keep saying, okay, folks, now first let's make sure the audience is laughing, and then we'll take care of making each other laugh.
And then we can do this.
Yes, that's right.
One of the things that's great about this play at this time is that it's sort of antithetical to the usual holiday stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
And for those of us who aren't really into the sappy holiday things, you know, it's a really wonderful way to just enjoy yourself.
That's right, because we all want an event to go out. Too. We want to gather friends together, family, and go out and see something. And this is it gives you all of the things that you get from a holiday show. It's a delightful night. You laugh. You have a great time. It's just a wonderful evening. And you don't have to see the same story each time. Not that saying the same story isn't great, I mean, there's something to be said for ritual and going to see. But the beauty now is that folks can come see Christmas Carol and they can come see Noises Off. And who doesn't want another reason to go out for a great night of theater?
Right. And who doesn't want another reason to laugh?
That's right.
You know, because we certainly don't get enough of it.
We do not get enough of it. Laughing, I mean, it's just so cliche. Laughter is the best medicine. But honestly, since I've been here in rehearsal, my skin has cleared up. I'm getting a good night of sleep. My hair looks better than it ever has. I look in the mirror and I'm thinking, like, why am I looking so healthy? And it's because I have been laughing so hard.
For hours a day.
For hours a day. Maybe right. That sounds ridiculous, but honestly, it has been very good for my skin.
That's it. So it's not only theater, it's Fountain of Youth.
It's Fountain of Youth. And it's a gym because I think you burn more calories when you laugh. I am making that up right now, but I am committed to it. Yes.
That's perfect.
I do. I heard somewhere that you burn more calories when you laugh.
Well, you use more when you smile, right?
See, there you go.
More muscles get used in your face, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
So not only can you come laugh your face off, then afterwards you can have a huge dinner.
And dessert.
And dessert.
Right.
You've burnt it all off.
That's right. Before you've even gotten there.
That's right.
Perfect. It's perfect. So after this opens, what's next for you?
Oh, gosh. Now I'm going into a panic. What's after? What is after? No, here's what I'm doing next. I'm going back to New York. Well, I live in Jersey. I live in a town called West New York, New Jersey. That's really the name of the town. We have a mayor of West New York, New Jersey.
Right. And I have to say you're wearing a Boston Red Sox cap in the studio here. So that's kind of amusing, too.
That's right. And I got this cap 3 years ago. And really, I got it to walk around New York City and make Yankees fans angry. And then I started to like the hat. And then I started to like the team. I'm a terrible fan. I'm a fair weather fan. But, you know, actually, what's next for me is I'm a big fan of football. And I went to the Packers-Bears game the other night.
Oh.
It was my first time in Lambeau Field. And boy, was that a spectacular experience. I mean, not great that they lost and not great that Aaron Rodgers got hurt. But it was a dream come true for me to be in that stadium. But anyway, what's next is I have a commission from Berkeley Rep and Baltimore Center Stage to write a play about football. So I've been interviewing football players. I'm writing a play about all of these things that are coming up right now with concussions. And so I have a staged reading of it 4 weeks from yesterday.
Oh,
gasp.
In Baltimore or Berkeley?
In Baltimore.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So
and then it'll go coast to coast?
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah. So well, I'm going from high farce, from the ridiculous to the profound, and then hopefully back to the ridiculous again.
Yes, because we need all of that.
Yeah.
We need the I don't want to say ridicule. That's not what we need. We need the ridiculousness.
Yeah, that's
of,
right.
Of life.
Just ridiculous in the right places.
Yes. Yeah. Well, good luck with the play. I hope maybe you'll get to bring it here.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. My hope is that it's a play that is not only entertaining, but sheds some light on the subject and serves as a bridge between people. So hopefully it's a play that a lot of theaters will want to do.
Yeah. And this is football country. So,
yeah.
You know, I can't imagine that people wouldn't be interested.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it has been such a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thanks, Bonnie. It's
been
a delight.
Can't wait to see the play. It opens tomorrow night. Preview starts tomorrow night.
That's right.
Okay. And it opens on Friday?
That's right. And I hope that I see some of your listeners while I'm here. I'll be here through previews and then opening. I'm so looking forward to watching people watch the play. I look forward to seeing faces falling all around me as they laugh our face off.
And the sardines fly.
And the sardines will be flying, yeah.
Lovely, lovely. Well, KJ, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
KJ Sanchez is visiting director at the Milwaukee Rep. She directs the Rep's production of Noises Off, which opens tomorrow night at the Rep's Quadracci Powerhouse Pavilion. It runs through December 22nd. Sanchez spoke with Bonnie North. That's all for the Monday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you with us today, as it always is, for Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.